We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At this very time, they, that is the British, are permitting their chief magistrate, King George, to send over not only soldiers of our common blood, but Scotch and foreign mercenaries to invade and deluge us in blood.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Today, we're finishing up our survey of reactions to the Declaration of Independence in the various nations of the British Isles. We've already released episodes on Ireland and Wales, and so we're ending today with the Kingdom of Scotland. Today, there are about 5.5 million people living in Scotland. In the United States, 10 million Americans officially claim to be of Scotch or Scotch-Irish descent. And the U.S. Census from 2000 estimated that a further 15 million people are of Scottish descent, so about 25 million in all. And the Scots have been an important part of American history since its very founding. In fact, one could argue that British America was founded by a Scotsman, King James VI of Scotland, who was also King James I of England, and the first British American colony, Jamestown, founded in 1607, was named after him. In 1700, 3% of the population of the colonies was Scottish, but by 1775, that number had doubled to about 7%, and by 1790, it had doubled yet again to 14%. Also in 1790, about 27% of the inhabitants of Georgia were Scottish, followed by South Carolina at 25% Scottish, and North Carolina at 20% Scottish. In 1776, when the Declaration was signed, two of the 56 of the signatories had been born in Scotland, James Wilson and John Witherspoon, and many others were of Scottish descent. The early Scottish settlers were a diverse group, religiously, economically, and politically. They had come to the colonies for different reasons, and they had wildly different opinions about King George, Parliament, and the British Empire. In fact, if we think of the War of Independence as an American Civil War, we can also think of it as a miniature Scottish Civil War, a war of Scots fighting Scots, not in the highlands of Scotland, but in the hills of North Carolina. Indeed, at the Battle of King's Mountain in 1780, Scottish-American patriots defeated Scottish-American loyalists in an important battle that helped to turn the tide of the Southern campaign in the Revolutionary War. So, today we're going to explore Scotland and the Declaration of Independence. What was Scotland like in the 1700s? Why did the Scots move to the colonies? What did they think about rebellion against Britain? And how did the Declaration of Independence influence Scottish politics back home? And here with me today to help us answer these questions is Professor Frank Colliano.
Thank you, Andrew.
Frank is Professor of History at the University of Edinburgh, Scotland. He has authored numerous books on the American Revolution, including Revolutionary America, 1763 to 1815, A Political History, now in its fourth edition. And he is also the editor of the forthcoming volume, The American Revolution at 250. 24 historians reflect on the founding. So, Frank, let's just start with those two passages that you brought up. The first passage is the most famous passage we remember from the Declaration of Independence, but forgive me for saying I'm not familiar with that second passage about the deluge of blood being brought by Scottish mercenaries. So what's going on there?
You see, Andrew, that's in the director's cut. So that second passage about Scotch and other foreign mercenaries is from Jefferson's rough draft of the Declaration of Independence, and it was cut out during the editing process by Congress. In partial deference to the two Scots in the room that you mentioned, who might have said, hey, wait a second. But it's interesting on a couple of levels. One is, it talks about soldiers of our common blood. The king's not only sending soldiers of our common blood, that is English soldiers, but Scotch and foreign mercenaries. And the foreignness of the Scots and the other foreign mercenaries are, of course, Germans. But he's drawing a distinction there between people like himself, although he was probably of Welsh descent as well as English descent, but of, if you will, people of English descent in the colonies and the Scots. And so there's an othering of Scots going on there, which was quite common in the 18th century. There was a surge in Scottish migration of the colonies, and the figures you said at the top give some indication of that. About 40,000 Scots emigrated to the colonies just between 1763 and 1775. So there's a surge in arrivals from Scotland just on the eve of the Revolution. If we count the Scots-Irish, and I realize just how complicated that whole question is, but if you count
that's actually my next question.
if you count the Scots-Irish, there's about 200,000 who emigrate during the 18th century. So there are a lot of Scots and people of Scottish descent in the colonies, and there's some tension around them, not least because, and this applies to Jefferson in particular, the large Virginia planters like Jefferson and George Washington were often indebted to Scottish merchants and Scottish factors to whom they sold their tobacco. So the image of Scots in the colonies was not entirely positive. And I think that's reflected in that passage that Jefferson wrote in his original draft that was excised by Congress.
Fascinating. So how about that first famous passage that you chose? Just briefly, why did you choose to read that as well?
Yes, I mean, that will be very familiar. That's the money shot, if you will, from the Declaration of Independence. Everybody knows that. And you might ask, what does that have to do with the Scots? Well, the famous expression from John Locke is life, liberty, and property. And life, liberty, and property is a commonplace expression in the Anglophone Atlantic world in the 18th century, and that's the formulation that was most familiar to people. It's a puzzle, if you will, why Jefferson said life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. About 50 years ago, Gary Wills, the famous American public intellectual, made an argument which I find quite persuasive, arguing that the pursuit of happiness comes from Scotland and the Scottish Enlightenment, particularly Francis Hutcheson, who was a professor of moral philosophy at the University of Glasgow, a neighboring institution of mine. It's an interesting story because Hutcheson was actually born in Dublin. He's associated with the Scottish Enlightenment, but he was Irish born. So there's a circulation of ideas in these islands in the 18th century and beyond, and we see a reflection of that. But Hutcheson's argument was that people had a sense of happiness, a kind of moral sense. It was one of the senses, like the sense of smell or sight, and that this is one of the things that inclined people to form societies and to behave. And so when Jefferson is talking, referencing the pursuit of happiness, this can be directly tied to the influence of the Scottish Enlightenment. Jefferson famously said many, many years, decades after he wrote the Declaration of Independence, "I was just expressing what was in the air." I think there's a bit of false modesty there, but it is interesting that he makes a pivot from life, liberty, and property to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I've been in the UK a very, very long time, but soon after I arrived, I was teaching this at the University of Edinburgh, and a Scottish student said to me, who is perhaps unaware of this history, said, "Oh, the pursuit of happiness. Only a country that had California in it would have that in its founding document." make of that what you will. So, but the irony being that the pursuit of happiness is not attributable to California, which of course was not a state in 1776, but to Scotland itself.
Yeah, and I think it's important, and I really like the fact that you chose to open with these two passages, the one deleted passage about the deluge of blood that the Scots are bringing, which really clearly shows one side of the Scottish coin here, which is the loyalist British imperial side. And we contrast that then with this phrase that you're saying, the pursuit of happiness, which is represents Scottish American patriotism and these Enlightenment ideas that theoretically founded our country and we see throughout the Declaration of Independence. And I think we should keep those two ideas here throughout. I mean, Scotland was divided and conflicted itself back then, and we see that conflict reproduced in the colonies. Very briefly, can you explain the difference between the Scots and the Scotch-Irish?
Sure, sure. So the Scots-Irish were people. The historian Patrick Griffin's written a very good book about them called The People with No Name. The Scots-Irish were people who migrated, mainly Protestants, mainly Presbyterians, I should say, who migrated from Scotland to Ulster in the 17th century as part of English expansion and English-sponsored expansion in Ireland, an imperial settlement in Ireland. And they settled in Ulster, and they are the antecedents in many respects to today's Ulster Unionist population, or the Unionist population in Northern Ireland, or the north of Ireland. I'm not making any kind of political statement about that country, about that place, or any intervention there. So the north of Ireland or Northern Ireland, depending on your preference. And in the 18th century, many of their descendants, in some cases the same people, then emigrated to North America and settled there. And so the Scots-Irish, as they were called, or the Scotch-Irish, as they're called in North America, are an incredibly important segment of the population. As I said a few minutes ago, there were about 200,000 of them emigrated during the 18th century. Many of them emigrated to the colonies, particularly to Pennsylvania, where they moved both west and south down the Appalachian Mountain Range, which is why we get significant populations of both Scots and Scots-Irish in Pennsylvania, Virginia, North and South Carolina, and Georgia, and the figures you cited at the top. So there's a very substantial Scots-Irish presence in the colonies, and many of the white people who live in Appalachia today are descended from those Scots-Irish. So there's a significant population.
Would it be fair to characterize the Scots-Irish as primarily Protestant and Presbyterian, and then the Scots to be characterized as primarily Catholic?
It would be right to call the Scots-Irish primarily Presbyterian. The Scots who emigrate are more mixed. There are both Catholics and Presbyterians.
And could we make the assumption that, by and large, the Presbyterians and Protestants were more likely to be loyalists or patriots, or is that also a difficult generalization to make?
That is a difficult generalization to make, because we get some prominent Presbyterians, James Wilson among them, John Witherspoon, who support the revolution. So it's not quite that simple, although lots of the folks who are loyalists in the South were Presbyterians. It's very complicated, because you get, you know, some of the former Jacobites, and I'm sure we'll get to this, who emigrated to the colonies after the 1745-46 Jacobite Rising in Scotland, were Catholics or sympathetic to a Catholic restoration of the Catholic monarchy, and they end up being loyalists. A lot of them end up being loyalists. It's a very complicated situation. It doesn't easily, the kind of sociology of loyalism doesn't easily help us when it comes to the Scots.
Right. And I think we learned that lesson, too, with the episode on French Canada. You would expect,
sure,
perhaps, that the French Canadian Catholics would have joined the revolution, but indeed they didn't. They chose to be loyal to a Protestant king, which again, warps or sort of challenges our assumptions about religion and the importance of religion in taking a side in a conflict like this. Okay, let's now go back to Scotland. You mentioned the Jacobite uprising and all of this. And I just want to get a picture of what Scotland was like in the 1700s. And when we talk about migration, we talk about push and pull factors. So what is happening in Scotland that's pushing them out of Scotland in the 1700s? And what's pulling them towards the North American colonies? I usually think about politics, economics, and religion, but that might be different here.
I think economics is the most important factor until the end of the century, when there is a surge in immigration because of politics after the revolution. But in terms of the period before the American Revolution, I think economics is the answer. Scotland's a poor country at that point. It's one reason why we see so many Scots in the British Army, for example, and accepting posts in various parts of the British Empire. There's a huge out-migration of Scots during the 18th century to North America, but also to London. London is a favorite destination, and that's largely motivated, I think, by an apparent lack of economic opportunity. Because of the prevalence of Protestantism, however, in Scotland, there's a relatively high literacy rate, as we see in colonial and 18th century New England, for example. And so Scots are successful often when they migrate to places like London or North America because of their the skills and attributes they bring with them. And so although there's some antipathy towards them, as expressed by Jefferson in his original draft of the Declaration, there's also some of that antipathy is a result of the fact that the Scots are perceived as successful when they migrate. But back to your question as to what's pushing them, I think it's mainly poverty. Scotland then as now is a very, the population of Scotland is not evenly distributed. So it's a country with a huge amount of countryside that's really quite beautiful. I would recommend all people should visit if they can. But it's also an urban country. So it's a place of urban centers. The two biggest in the 18th century then and now are Glasgow and Edinburgh, of course. But the central belt across the south of Scotland has a lot of towns and a couple of major cities. And then we get sort of other cities like Dundee, for example, that are not insignificant in size. And so what we see is we've got a population in the so-called central belt, which is urban and often not terribly wealthy. And a lot of that's supplying a lot of migrants. We think of Highlanders migrating, and we do get a migration from the Highlands. And the people who go from the Highlands are often Gaelic speaking, and they're agricultural, they're farm folk who come from the Highlands and Islands. But there aren't as many of them in terms of in proportional terms. There is the beginning of what will become to be known as the Highland clearances are starting in the 18th century as well. So we see some landlords enclosing their land and forcing tenant farmers off their land. And so some of the people who migrate to America are rural folk who migrate. In both cases, whether they be rural or urban, these are people who are migrating mainly for economic opportunity. And they scatter throughout the British Empire, not just North America, but also, as I said, to London and to the Caribbean and other parts of the British Empire.
And why don't we look at the religious part of this equation? Are they seeing, say, in the colony of Maryland, a place where they could practice Catholicism without prejudice? Or are there Scottish sects that are, you know, like the Baptists or something, that are not particularly liked in the British Isles, and so they're looking to go to the colonies for a little bit less repression?
There's a little of that, although, as I said, I think it's mainly economic during most of the 18th century. So what we see, though, is Scots Presbyterian communities emerging again in the western parts of Virginia, North and South Carolina, and Georgia, that often find themselves at odds with the established, still Protestant, but Anglican church in those colonies. So we see, you know, the South Carolina Regulation, which is a kind of rebellion, proto-rebellion on the eve of the American Revolution in 1771, involves Scots and Scots-Irish settlers in the backcountry at odds with low country planters, and there is a religious dimension to that. It's not only about religion, it's about politics as well, but there is a religious dimension to that, with Presbyterian settlers in the backcountry finding themselves at odds with Anglican planters in the low country.
Okay, so we've looked at economics a little bit and religion a little bit. Now let's take sort of the big other topic, which is politics. Scotland has a long history of conflict with England, the British Empire. You were talking about the Jacobite uprising. Just help give our audience some sort of basic understanding of what's going on politically and what these sort of conflicting views are about the King of England, King George, the British Empire, etc.
Sure. The British Empire only truly becomes British in 1707 with the Act of Union, which brings Scotland together with England and Wales. And so it's still a relatively new union for most of the period we're talking about. And although it was a voluntary union, Scotland was not conquered by England, there was a perception that it was an unequal union. Scotland has a much smaller population than England. It's about 10% of the English population today. And there's a fear and a belief with some, not without some merit, that the British Empire and the British state is basically it's biased in favor of England. and the Scots give up their parliament with the Act of Union in 1707. As you indicated at the outset, Andrew, they shared a monarch, but they were seen as two separate kingdoms. With the Act of Union, that's no longer the case. The Scottish Parliament is abolished and Scotland is governed from London. And there is some resentment as a consequence of that. There are still separate Scottish institutions to this day. We have a separate education system. We have a separate legal system. And those institutions persist. But there's tension in this relationship. And for reasons that are sort of beyond my ken, because I'm not really a Scottish historian of the 18th century, there are a series of rebellions, or a couple of rebellions, in the 18th century, in 1715 and 1745 in particular, which seek a restoration of the Stuarts, the Stuart dynasty, to replace the Hanoverians as the kings of Great Britain. And we see in both 1715 and 1745 these so-called Jacobite risings. Jacobite means, like, is the Latin for James. They want to restore the Stuart monarchies. These fail. There's a religious element to this because the Stuarts are Catholic, but not without significant bloodshed, especially in 1745 and 1746. Now, this violence, these risings and the response to them is often seen as the English or British conquering or waging war against the Scots. It's more complicated than that. The support for Bonnie Prince Charlie, the pretender in 1745, the Stuart pretender, as he's called by his critics, was largely in the Highlands and Islands. Yet Lowland Scots from the Central Belt, from Edinburgh, including Edinburgh, where I'm sitting today, supported the British in suppressing that rising. So it's more complicated than just the English versus the Scots. It almost always is in the history of the Scottish-English relationship. But what we see is the, in 1745, is the British state extending and exercising considerable control over Scotland. And that engenders some antipathy on the part of Scots. And so what we see after the 45, as it's called, is some Scots go into exile into the colonies. So those are political migrants. Flora MacDonald is very famous as a woman who helped save Bonnie Prince Charlie, the pretender, during the rising. She ends up in North Carolina. She's probably the archetype for this migration. So we do see some people who go into political exile in the colonies as a result in the aftermath of the 45. And the 45 is also important for another reason, which is, and I think this is largely forgotten in both English-centered discourse and American memory as well, the British state has experience suppressing a rebellion in the living memory of the American Revolution. In 1775, when the rebellion breaks out, when the war breaks out in the colonies, there are people in the British state and military who participated in suppressing the 45 in Scotland. And in many respects, the 45 in Scotland seemed to be a greater threat because it was closer to home. And they successfully suppressed that rebellion through a combination of force and then kind of offering some reforms in the aftermath of the rebellion. So that's in the memory of policymakers in London, I think, in 1775, 30 years later, when the American War of Independence breaks out. And that's largely left out of the story because I think, or it's seen as this sort of kind of footnote. But I think it's more important in terms of understanding some of the choices the British make early on in the war than we generally reckon.
Yeah, well, when I think of some of the religious, political, economic conflicts in the colonies being reproduced in the British Isles, I mean, this is a perfect example here. We have essentially a civil war in Scotland, right? You can call it a rebellion. Sure. Maybe we call it a civil war. You see people with different religious beliefs, people from different economic caste, because the Highland farmers are farmers, the belt, the lowland, city belt, central belt, townies are townies, so we get some this economic conflict too. And obviously there's this idea of political conflict when we think of the American Revolution being a rebellion against government from far away.
Yep.
You know, you have these Scots saying, why did you abolish the Scottish Parliament and move everyone to London? We want more local rule. And you can look at the American Revolution as that there. So what do you think about sort of that?
Yeah, I think
frame?
That's right. I think that is a good frame. And I think it's always, I think it's, we really need to think of the American Revolution as a civil war. It's both a British Revolution and a British Civil War. So I think that's the right way to frame it. And it very much comes out of the tradition of revolution and civil war that we see in England, Wales, Ireland, and Scotland during the 17th and 18th centuries. First, the Civil War, you know, the English Civil War of the 1640s, the Glorious Revolution of 1689, the Jacobite Risings, and the American Revolution. I think they're all, I think one important way to think about them is to think of them in that context. I think because we call it the War of Independence and because the colonies won their independence and became the United States, and it's the beginning of a different national history, we've slightly forgotten, I think, that kind of continuity with the history of Britain and the British Empire that precedes it.
Good. And let's talk about then that intellectual history. And let's return now to the Scottish Enlightenment. So what are these sort of specific ideas of self-rule, life, liberty, property, pursuit of happiness? Can you just unpack some of these, what we think of maybe wrongly as quintessentially American ideas? How are they coming to the States from Scotland through the Scottish Enlightenment?
As I indicated a few minutes ago, Scotland is poor relative to other parts of the British Empire in the 18th century, relatively poor, but well-educated. It's got these urban centers that are centers of commerce. It's got universities. There are six ancient universities in the United Kingdom: Oxford, Cambridge, Edinburgh, Glasgow, St. Andrews, and Aberdeen. Scotland, with 10% of the population, has twice as many ancient universities as England does. So Scotland is, if you will, in the 18th century, overeducated. And as a consequence of that, what we see emerge, especially in urban Scotland, is this kind of efflorescence of thinking and thought. And we get some, you know, we get advances in economics. Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations is first published in 1776. William Robertson, the great historian, is the principal of Edinburgh University at this time. We get moral philosophy, Hume, Hutcheson, and so on. We know the names. There's a great flowering that goes on in the 18th century in Scotland that is really, really quite important in terms of European intellectual history, the history of the British Empire, but also in shaping America. Because what we see is not just the transmission or the movement of peoples and goods around the Atlantic world, but ideas. And in some cases, those people are transmitting the ideas. James Wilson and John Witherspoon, for two, who are in this Continental Congress. Witherspoon becomes the president of Princeton and shapes the university, the development of the university curriculum in the United States. But we see ideas, you know, transmitted in books and pamphlets and newspapers as well. And it's not, I mean, there's often a lot of Scottish kind of parochialism around the Scottish Enlightenment that kind of influences the way we understand it today. And there's this sort of boosterism that I don't find terribly helpful. But there is something going on in Scotland. There's no doubt there's something going on in Scotland. And that the spread of these ideas, which spreads along with the migration of people and the trade in goods, is incredibly important in helping to shape what's going on in the colonies and how the colonists understand their relationship with Britain as they come to question it. Now, Bernard Bailyn, many, you know, almost 60 years ago, in his Ideological Origins of the American Revolution, unpacked the ideas that the colonists were expressing and the books they were reading. They weren't only reading the Scots. I want to be clear about that. But there's certainly a Scottish inflection. And we see that in the example I gave you at the top, where we see, you know, Francis Hutcheson influencing Jefferson's thinking when it comes to the pursuit of happiness and that sense of happiness.
And indeed, Franklin, I believe, met Hume in Scotland in the 1770s, in the early 1770s.
Yeah, Franklin received honorary degrees from Edinburgh and St. Andrews, and he met Hume. Benjamin Rush, signatory to the Declaration of Independence, was educated at the University of Edinburgh. He was a student at the University of Edinburgh Medical School. So beyond the Scots who go out, we also have Americans coming in. 10% of the students at the University of Edinburgh in 1776 were American.
It's fascinating. That's really interesting.
Yeah. So they're being educated and taking those ideas back with them.
Yeah. And let's indeed cross the Atlantic once again and look at the Scots in the colonies, let's say around 1770 to 1775. What is the general attitude of Scots in the colonies? Are they at this point referring to themselves as being Americans? Are they referring to themselves as being Georgians or Virginians? Are they referring to themselves as Scottish Americans? To what extent is their identity Scottish now, in, say, between 1770 and the outbreak of war in 1775?
Oh, this is a difficult one. I think...
Sorry.
No, that's okay. That's okay. I think they see themselves as Scots, in part because they're seen as Scots. We get that phrase from Jefferson's original rough draft. They're being heard and seen as Scots, which reinforces that identity. And Scots have mixed reputations in these colonies. In some cases, they're welcome and they're seen, especially where their numbers predominate, they're seen as good, God-fearing folk. In others, they're seen as basically chiseling merchants who are taking our money and taking our tobacco and ripping us off. There's a stream, there's a thread of Scotophobia in the colonies that's pretty potent in particular areas. And we see this expressed in cartoons and in print sometimes. So it depends on circumstance, but I still think most of them are seen as Scots. Now, whether those who are second and third generation see themselves as Scots or Americans is more debatable. It's less clear. To some extent, that's what this whole revolution's about. They're figuring out who they are, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You've mentioned the tobacco trade a couple of times, and I think at this point in Europe, the tobacco trade was dominated by merchant traders in Scotland and their offices in Virginia, for example. And there was quite a complex mercantile system going on. And that was actually problematic and potentially also a reason for the American Revolution. So can you talk a little bit about the tobacco industry and the tobacco trade and Scotland?
Sure. If anybody has the opportunity to visit Glasgow, Glasgow has some amazing 18th century buildings. And most of those buildings were paid for by the trade in tobacco. And Glasgow is, of course, a port in the west of Scotland. And Glasgow merchants became, along with merchants in Liverpool, it should be said, really, really important in the transatlantic trade, especially to Maryland, Virginia, and North Carolina, the colonies that are producing the most tobacco. And Glasgow merchants become what are called, they send out what are called factors who buy tobacco. They're basically, they buy lots of tobacco. Tobacco planters, like many people who work in agriculture, like many farmers, and I'm using that kind of term loosely, are often in debt because that's the nature of the agricultural economy. You know, the crops only come in a couple times a year, once or twice a year, but you need food and clothes all year round. And so they often have to borrow against their crops. And that means that the tobacco factors and the merchants, many of whom are Scots, in that region are extending credit to planters and they're selling them stuff. You know, they want nice things. They want books. They want China. They want clothes from Britain and Europe. And the factors are selling them goods as well as extending them credit. And this creates a relationship that's very lucrative for both sides. You can look at these grand houses in Glasgow. You can also visit George Washington's Mount Vernon. That's not a small house, and it's full of interesting stuff. And let's not forget that all the labor provided in this industry is provided, or most of the labor is provided by enslaved people. But people on both sides of the Atlantic are profiting off this, yet there's a belief on the part of the planters that they're being cheated often by their business partners.
By the chiseling Scots.
And so this really reinforces that negative stereotype. On the other hand, one of George Washington's closest friend and his doctor, James Craik, was a Scottish educated doctor, educated at these universities that are doing such a good job producing knowledge in the 18th century. So it's not a straightforward, oh, we hate all the Scots, but there's an antipathy towards the Scots, especially in the Chesapeake region, as a result of this relationship. As I said, this relationship has worked pretty well for both sides for a good long time, but there's a belief that that relationship is imbalanced and skewed towards the Scots.
And when war breaks out, in fact, there is then very much a split of people siding with patriots and then Scots siding with King George. And I believe a town is burned because it is the center of the Scottish tobacco trade in the Chesapeake area, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Norfolk, Virginia is burned early in the war. And there's a belief that, I mean, there are some people who support the revolution because they think, oh, we can clear our debts this way. The post-war...
it's all about money.
Yeah. The post-war status of the pre-war debts is going to be a major issue in British-American relations for a couple of decades. Not all the Scots support the British, but many do. Many do become loyalists. And it's a real head-scratcher, actually, it's a conundrum to explain why is it like descendants of the Jacobites, or in some cases the Jacobites themselves, like Flora MacDonald in North Carolina, become loyalists. You think, you people rebelled against the British state, you should be with the patriots. And we don't really have an adequate answer for that. There are varieties of answers have been put forward, but to some extent what we see, especially in the South, is that civil war you referenced with British settlers against each other, native peoples dragged in, enslaved peoples dragged in. And it's a very, very complicated and bloody war. And people are making choices for political reasons, in terms of self-preservation. But we see a lot of Scots, not all, but a lot of Scots become loyalists. And explaining that is something that has more or less bedeviled historians ever since. I mean, the prevailing view, which I find pretty compelling, is it really does depend on local circumstances. So, you know, in the backcountry of North and South Carolina, we see Scots who think, well, you know what, I don't like those people in the Low Country who have never given us political rights anyway. So, you know, I think I've got a better shot under the British Empire than I would being governed by them. And I think there's a lot of merit to that. And to some extent, it's just a matter of once the cycle of violence starts, it becomes very, very difficult to stop.
Yeah, and that reminds me a lot about the episodes on Wales and Ireland. It's very difficult to make any generalizations about which side someone would take. And indeed, in a maritime episode, we remember that some sailors would change sides as many as 12 times in the conflict.
That's right. That's
just
right.
Royal Navy, Continental Navy, Royal Navy, Continental Navy. And then at the end, they're like, okay, here I am. But I want to take the story back to Scotland now. So the war breaks out, Lexington and Concord, 1775. And then the Declaration of Independence is released, of course, on the 4th of July of 1776. How are the Scots reacting to this in that central belt of towns and cities, and also in the Highlands?
I think that they've already decided what they think once the war starts. So although there are some Scottish radicals, just as there are radicals in England, who side with the patriots throughout the conflict, and think that they're right, think they've got some, you know, that their cause is just. And this is where we're back to it being another British Civil War. Most people are either indifferent or they respond in a patriotic fashion. Their country's at war and they side with their country. Whether they see their country as Scotland or Britain is a different discussion. But I think they're worried about the disruption in trade. They're worried about the economic impact on them. There is an economic impact in Scotland of the War of Independence because trade is disrupted. But most, I think, are indifferent or inclined towards Britain, with some outspoken political radicals siding with the Patriots in America. The war comes to Scotland in little ways. John Paul Jones raids the Scottish coast, the Solway Firth, during the war, and he himself is a Scot. Not far from where I'm sitting today in Edinburgh Castle, which is a major military base at the time, one of the earliest American flags in terms of graffiti is carved into one of the doors. And that was done by a sailor who was imprisoned in Edinburgh Castle during the conflict. So the war comes to Scotland in small ways. But I think most people are either indifferent to the Declaration of Independence or they're inclined to support Britain. Having said that, its afterlife is really important in Scotland because there's a
that's what I want to discuss now, the wider political implications of the Declaration of Independence on Scotland, because over the years, obviously, Scottish independence, the Scotland nationalist movement has only been growing for the last 250 years. And do we see then that the American Revolution and the American Declaration of Independence sort of, you said there are some radicals in 1776, but did this help radicalize people more? I know in Ireland, the fact that the American colonies were successful in their war of independence, that actually succeeded in being independent, was kind of this really important concept that people had been thinking of rebelling, but they never thought they could succeed. But now here we have a case of colonies succeeding and breaking free.
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent question, Andrew. I think we see in the immediate aftermath of the American Revolution and the French Revolution, it should be said, that Scottish radicals really, really look to America and France as models. And there's a surge in migration, political migration, in the 1790s from Scotland to the United States. We see a number of radicals who are in part worried about the stricter sedition laws in Britain in the aftermath of the French Revolution. And these are basically political exiles. And so we see some Scottish radicals going to the United States after independence. So whereas before, at the beginning, as we discussed earlier, most of the migrants, I think, were economic migrants. In the 1790s and first decade of the 19th century, we see political radicals going to the United States and seeing the United States as a possible model for the future. In terms of the bigger question that you asked about Scottish independence, the afterlife of the Declaration of Independence in Scotland is very, very interesting. So I have attended many, many an Independence Day event here in Scotland, American Independence Day event, where somebody from the government, from the Scottish National Party, has stood up and made a connection between the Declaration of Arbroath of 1320 and the American Declaration of Independence. And they've said it's an article of faith among certain nationalists, both here in Scotland and in the United States, that there's a direct connection between the Declaration of Arbroath and the U.S. Declaration of Independence.
Sorry, Frank, I don't think our audience is aware potentially of the Declaration of Arbroath, nor am I.
The Declaration of Arbroath is a letter written by Scottish aristocrats, essentially, in 1320 to the Pope, asserting their identity. I'm not a Scottish medieval historian, but it's an expression of Scottishness and a collective Scottish identity to an external power in 1320. And the argument that is made in both on both sides of the Atlantic by small numbers of people, it should be said, is that there's a direct correlation between the Declaration of Arbor Oath and the U.S. Declaration of Independence. I want to be clear here, because I've said this repeatedly in Scotland, there is no connection. There is okay. no connection. This is an imagined connection. It's a very interesting story, however, because of what it tells us about national identity in the aftermath and how the Declaration of Independence and has been used and appropriated after the fact. So it's interesting to me. The Declaration of Arbor Oath wasn't even known as the Declaration of Arbor Oath until the 1920s. It was previously called the Papal Letter. But the number of times I've heard people say, yeah, but it's an inspiration for the American Declaration of Independence. There's a huge Scottish influence on America, as we've spent the past hour discussing. There's a direct Scottish influence on the American Declaration of Independence, but it is not the Declaration of Arbor Oath. I think that what we see, though, is that advocates for some advocates for independence here in Scotland are seeking to draw this connection for their own political reasons here. I mean, so I once spoke to a government minister from the Scottish National Party, and I said to her, I said, look, you really have to stop saying this. It's not true. And she said, yeah, but there's a debate about it, isn't there? I said, there's only a debate about it because you keep saying it. I said, there's no evidence. There's no evidence that Jefferson was inspired by the Declaration of Arbor Oath when he drafted the Declaration of Independence, or that it came up in Congress when they were debating the independence. Its afterlife is really, really interesting, however. The fact that this has had such an impact, this belief, is really interesting, to the extent that April 6th, which is the day the Declaration of Arbor Oath is dated, April 6th, 1320, April 6th is now Tartan Day in the United States. And so it's the day that's celebrated, and this was enacted as by Congress in the 90s. It's an official holiday in the United States acknowledging Scottish-American connections. And the day chosen to mark this, April 6th, is the anniversary of the Declaration of Arbor Oath. So the Declaration of Arbor Oath is incredibly important in terms of Scottish identity and Scottish-American identity. Its connection to the American Declaration of Independence is non-existent.
But I don't think it matters. And maybe I'll just end
That's right.
with asking what I ask all my guests. As a historian looking at the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, what are the big takeaways? For me, one of the big takeaways of this anniversary is it doesn't matter what the historical reality is. People read into the document and the founding whatever narrative that they want. And for the Scottish nationalists, if it's seeing a connection with the Declaration of Arbor Oath, so be it. Right. But this is a question for you, not for me.
You are absolutely right, Andrew. The Declaration, every generation makes the Declaration into what they need it to be. And I think when you're in an international context, it's particularly interesting to see that.
Okay. I forgot to ask you. I do have a very, very final question, which is whatever happened to those Scotch mercenaries that were going to deluge the colonies in blood?
Well, to some extent they succeeded because the American War of Independence was very bloody, but they also lost, at least those who fought for the British. But I think it's important to remember, Andrew, that there were Scots who fought in the British Army. There were Scots who fought in the Continental Army. There were Scots who fought in the Patriot and Loyalist militias. And there were just Scottish civilians who wanted to stay out of the whole thing. This was a civil war. It was a British civil war that resulted in the independence of the United States, but it involved the Scots as well. Scots played a prominent role at all levels and in all sides.
Professor Frank Cogliano, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Life, liberty. The pursuit of happiness.
you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.